Today's lesson is part 2 of lesson 11. And in part 2, we will complete the study of chapter 7. We stopped at the end of chapter 6. At the end of chapter 6, there appeared to be a movement of Job's friends to get away from him. And therefore, the concluding verses of chapter 6 see Job arguing with his friends and persuading them in a way to stay and hear him out, because as he says, he has a solid argument and he's only asking that they would patiently hear him out. So they seem to respond to that, because Job continues in chapter 7 with his discourse. You will note the transition from chapter 6 to chapter 7 is very smooth. And it is, if in chapter 6 he was addressing his friends, we may be tempted to think that he is continuing to do so in chapter 7. And we need to be careful here, because sometimes in this book, it is not clear as we go from one chapter to the next whether he is continuing to address his friends or is he addressing his discourse to God. So the content of chapter 7 makes it clear that he is, in that chapter, he is not addressing his friends, but he is addressing God. But the friends, of course, are right next to him, and they are privy to what he says. And in fact, the content of chapter 7, Job's discourse to God, is what provokes Bildad, the second of the three friends, to respond in chapter 8. So in chapter 7, we need to be clear that Job is addressing God. And Job's point of view is that my present afflictions seem to be directed to no end in particular. I can't see any reason why the Lord should have sent these upon me, because I have been righteous, I have been honorable. Why on earth am I punished so severely? One would expect this degree of punishment to be merited in the case of an unbeliever or an ungodly person. And this ignorance of why God sends certain types of affliction upon us, it exacerbates the pain of the affliction. As mentioned last week, when the human mind is so wired, if you want to think of it that way, that it is pattern seeking. It tries to make sense of chaos. It cannot live with a disorganized state of affairs. So the human mind always tries to see a pattern in the world, a pattern in what happens to oneself in the world. And it is certainly true also in the spiritual realm, that in the case of Job, it is perfectly understandable why he is looking for a cause. It is so with us also. When God seems to afflict us for no rhyme or reason that we can understand, the pain of that ordeal is even harder to bear. And this, in a way, is a greater test of faith, to continue to believe in God and trust in His good hand, even though things may not make sense to us. There is a hymn in which occur this particular line: faith in the night as well as in the day. And the image is very appropriate to chapter 7, to Job, because he couldn't make sense of his suffering. In chapter 3, there is a change, however, in chapter 7. In chapter 3, we find that Job gives vent to his frustration by bemoaning the day of his birth. And if you think about it, it is pointless for him or for anyone in the face of suffering to curse the day in which you were born. It's really pointless because you are born, you are in this world, and you cannot be unborn, so to speak. And this kind of fruitless activity is an indication of someone who is disoriented, so to speak. He hasn't got his bearings right. He's thrashing about trying to make sense of what is happening. But despite the pain and the agony, we find that by chapter 7, there is a change, a very subtle change, but a very important change. Gone is the confusion that we see in chapter 3. In chapter 7, the pain and the ordeal is no less. In fact, it is worse. But we find that Job is much more rational about it. And because of this, he is able to speak frankly. He is able to come to terms with his suffering. And that is a very important step to healing and recovery. From confusion, from complaint, from bemoaning the things that happen to oneself, to progress to a point where you are able to say, I have these problems. They are not going to go away. So let me take this as a starting point and let me see what I can approach God with to, as it were, bargain with God for some kind of reprieve or some kind of relief. And this is what we see Job doing in chapter 7. The confusion is very much reduced, and in its place there is an argument. For better or for worse, an argument that is rational, in which he seeks to present his case to God and argue or bargain for a release. And if you want to think of it that way, chapter 7 marks the start of the long process of reconciliation with God. So chapter 7 is an important turning point in the way Job handles his trials. And in chapter 7, there is, in the 21 verses, there is a certain pattern which I have highlighted on the whiteboard. And it helps us to understand the content if we are aware of the pattern. The first 6 verses, Job laments the physical and emotional pain that he has had to endure. This is perfectly understandable. So he cries out at his agony. In verses 7 to 10, he petitions God, having expressed the degree of suffering that he is undergoing. He is no longer arguing or complaining about it, but he frankly tells God, this is how I feel, this is what I am suffering within. And in verses 7 to 10, there is a petition. In this petition, Job is asking God to restore to him the joy of life. So it's a very rational process. You lament the pain that you are undergoing, frankly and objectively, and then you petition for a release or restoration of the joy of life. But then the agony of the situation comes bearing back upon you, upon Job. And in verses 11 through 16, he is back to complaining. So verses 11 through 16, he is no longer petitioning God, but he is complaining to God. And in the last few verses, 17 through 21, he goes back to petitioning God, taking up the theme of verses 7 through 10, that he now asks God for a reprieve from this round of, to him, still senseless suffering. And it is the content of what he says in chapter 7 that provokes Bildad to respond. And Bildad, you will find, is a very interesting character, extremely legalistic, not very, shall we say, original in his thoughts as compared with Eliphaz, very tradition-bound, and using tradition as his authority for whatever he wants to proclaim. And we see him, the archetypal Pharisee in the days long before the Pharisees, bearing down on Job and telling him why he deserves to suffer. So that is Bildad in chapter 8. Now, I direct your attention to the first three verses of chapter 7, where Job says, "Is there not an appointed time to man upon earth? Are not his days also like the days of an hireling? As a servant earnestly desireth the shadow, and as a hireling looketh for the reward of his work, so am I made to possess months of vanity, and wearisome nights are appointed to me." This needs some explanation. Job compares the life of an average person to a period of hard labor under the burning sun. And it is typically the kind of labor that would be performed by a slave or by a hired servant. So, for a slave doing this arduous job, the motivation for doing it is not reward, because as a slave, he's not going to be paid in material terms. But for the slave, the motivation is to get the day's work done as quickly as possible, and then have the night to rest and recover. So the motivation for the slave would be rest, the reward would be rest, but for the hireling, it would be reward, his payment for the day's wage. So Job says that in his case, he is like a slave. There is no material reward for his suffering, and all he can look forward to at the end of each day is the night when he can have a peaceful rest and forget about his suffering. But the problem is this, as he says, even at night I am denied proper rest, for my nights are, as he says, wearisome. And the Hebrew word that is used for wearisome is an interesting word, amal, which typically represents severe and protracted pain, like the pain of childbirth. So what he's saying is that where the night should be a time of rest for me, where I can recuperate and recover strength, it is in its own way as taxing and arduous as the day. And he uses a very strong word, amal, to indicate how the night is to him, where it should be, in fact, a time of rest. Moreover, he says, this state of affairs that he is undergoing is appointed to him, meaning to say that God has measured it out. That God doesn't do things without a purpose. That God seems to have targeted Job, and this is an idea which he will bring up later, that God seems to have targeted Job to almost like a guinea pig to see how human beings will respond to a long period of supposedly needless pain and suffering. In other words, he's in a way accusing God. It's a very strong term to use. He doesn't quite do that, but he comes quite close to accusing God of treating him like a guinea pig to see in an experiment how much a human being can endure suffering where that suffering is clearly unmerited. So this state of affairs is measured out to him, and that is the significance of appointed to me. He speaks, as you would recall, of the months of vanity, which point to the prolonged duration of his trial. So here's the situation. He has no peace during his waking hours. He has no rest at night. How long can a person carry on like this? I recall 4 years ago when I had an adverse drug reaction. For 4 days and 4 nights I was totally sleepless. By the morning of the 5th day, I was completely disoriented and I was in a state of panic. My blood pressure had shot up. So I can well empathize with what Job is saying. No peace during the day, no rest at night. There will come a point in time where the human being will just break down. And what he is saying is he's getting close to that point. God seems to be stretching him out to see how far God can tax a human being. That's Job's argument. The emotional and mental part is hard enough, but what Job tells us in verse 5 is that to supplement his emotional and mental anguish, there is a bodily suffering. And it's an interesting verse, and we can describe it as interesting because we are so far removed from it that we can take a clinical view of it. But we should be careful because we must remember that this is a description mouthed by a person who is undergoing the severest of trials. He tells us in verse 5, "My flesh is clothed with worms and clods of dust. My skin is broken and become loathsome." You can read it as it is and go on to the next verse. But if you focus on verse 5, you will realize that his description of his bodily suffering gives us a clue to the nature of the disease that Satan inflicted upon Job. This is a question which has excited the attention of many, many people who have studied the book of Job. We like to know as human beings all these fine details, and sometimes we miss the important lesson. But the details are in themselves useful, so we need to, there's nothing wrong in trying to probe further. Is there sufficient evidence in this verse to deduce the kind of disease that he was inflicted with? I say yes. It is not leprosy, because this is not the description of classical leprosy. The characteristic feature is boils, that recurring boils that break, the pus oozes out, and as a result of that, the dust of the earth sticks to the pus, and it hardens in time and becomes like a lump of clay. And then when the boil has burst, looking inside, he can see worms. Now this is not a fancy, because there is, now I have to be careful here, I am not a medical person, I am not claiming to have overnight become a specialist in tropical diseases. But taking the evidence and looking through the types of tropical diseases, if you go to Wikipedia on the net, you can type in tropical diseases and then check each one out and compare the symptoms with what Job has given. The best match that I can come up with is a disease called subcutaneous filariasis. Subcutaneous refers to the fatty layer just below the skin, and filariasis refers to microscopic worms. The disease vector, the agent that carries this parasite, is the mosquito. And it appears that this parasite, the worms, can get lodged either in the fatty layer under the skin, when it is called, the disease is called subcutaneous filariasis, or they can become lodged in the lymph glands. And as a result of that, fluid accumulates in the legs, and the legs become like the legs of an elephant, in which case the disease is called elephantiasis. If you look at the pictures on the net, I can guarantee a sleepless night, because they are really horrifying. Even I don't have the guts to see more than one or two of the pictures. So we can imagine what Job was suffering. Looks down at his body, he sees open sores, and in them wriggling away are tiny worms. This is enough to make a person lose his mind altogether. The Bible, of course, does not go into a medical diagnosis for the simple reason that the focus of this book is, and of the Bible as a whole, is always on the spiritual dimension of the experiences that human beings go through. While the material details are important, what should be focused on is the underlying spiritual dimension involved. So it is more the spiritual struggle of Job. How can a good and a just and a righteous God send this kind of affliction upon one who has no unconfessed sin on his record, who has lived a blameless life? How can a good and righteous God send this kind of suffering upon me? That is the spiritual struggle that is experienced by God's people through the ages, and we are not immune from it either. Verse 6. My days are swifter than a weaver's shuttle and are spent without hope. He's comparing his life to the weaving of a tapestry. And it is not so much that he's concerned with the speed with which one day blends into the next, as the fact that this tapestry, his life, would soon be woven. And when it is woven, the tapestry has to be removed from the frame on which the shuttle weaves under and over the warp. You have to cut the warp to release the tapestry from the frame. And he is now comparing his life to the cutting of the warp that releases the tapestry from the frame. And he's saying that his life, like a piece of tapestry, is soon going to be cut off. It is going to be finished, removed, without giving him any hope. He is referring, therefore, to the finality of physical death. He is not alone in using this analogy, because King Hezekiah, much later, and also in circumstances of prolonged suffering, also got to a point of depression where he uses terms which remind us so much of what Job has to say. If you care to look at Isaiah chapter 38, verse 12, remember these are the words of King Hezekiah. He says, "Mine age is departed," Isaiah 38:12, "and is removed from me as a shepherd's tent." That's one picture. He's talking about his life like a tent that is easily dismantled, packed up, and taken away. Now he uses a second analogy which is relevant to what Job has to say. He continues, Hezekiah continues to say, "I have cut off like a weaver my life." This is the warp being cut off to release the tapestry from the frame. "I have cut off like a weaver my life. He," that is Jehovah, "will cut me off with pining sickness." Doesn't that remind us of Job? "From day even to night wilt thou make an end of me." So we see the same analogies being used by Hezekiah to describe the response of a human being to a period of prolonged suffering. Then Job continues in verses 7 through 10. I shall read these and then explain those few verses that need some explanation. Verse 7, "Oh, remember that my life is wind. Mine eye shall no more see good. The eye of him that hath seen me shall see me no more. Thine eyes are upon me, and I am not. As a cloud is consumed and vanisheth away, so he that goeth down to the grave shall come up no more. He shall return no more to his house, neither shall his place know him any more." The metaphors in this section, verses 7 through 10, are on the whole easily understood, but it may be worth looking closely at verse 8. "The eye of him that hath seen me shall see me no more. Then he addresses God, thine eyes are upon me and I am not. What Job is saying is that God has suddenly turned his attention onto himself. And under the intensity of God's glare, if you like, focused on him, he feels he could not survive much longer. Such is the majesty of God that when he looks at a human being with that intensity, the human being kind of shrivels up. And Job is not exaggerating, because there are other portions of scripture that portray the majesty of Jehovah in very similar terms. For example, Psalm 104, verse 32. He, that is Jehovah, looketh on the earth and it trembleth. He toucheth the hills and they smoke. So what Job is saying is in accord with what the psalmist testifies as to the majesty of God. And if you recall, the people of Israel, when Moses came down from the mount, his face shone with such a glow, a reflected glow of the majesty of God, that they asked him to cover his face with a veil. And Revelation 20 verse 11 gives us a similar picture. And I, John, saw a great white throne and him that sat on it, from whose face, in other words, under the glare of whose eyes, earth and heaven fled away and there was found no place for them. So the picture is one of the sheer majesty of God, and Job is in line with the rest of scripture when he speaks of the intensity of God's gaze upon him, under which he is shriveling up and cannot last much longer. Verse 11, therefore I will not refrain my mouth, I will speak in the anguish of my spirit, I will complain, interesting word, in the bitterness of my soul. Why does he now make bold to talk about complaining? Because he's been under so much pressure that he says, I'm going to be cut off anyway, so I might as well use the last few hours or days of my life to voice my complaint to God. And his complaint to God needs to be looked at in some detail, verses 12 through 21. Am I a sea or a whale that thou settest a watch over me? When I say, my bed shall comfort me, my couch shall ease my complaint, then thou scarest me with dreams and terrifiest me through visions, so that my soul chooseth strangling and death rather than my life. I loathe it, I would not live alway. Let me alone, for my days are vanity. What is man that thou shouldest magnify him, and that thou shouldest set thine heart upon him, and that thou shouldest visit him every morning, and try him every moment? How long wilt thou not depart from me, nor let me alone till I swallow down my spittle? I have sinned, what shall I do unto thee, O thou preserver of men? Why hast thou set me as a mark against thee, so that I am a burden to myself? And why dost thou not pardon my transgression, and take away my iniquity? For now shall I sleep in the dust, thou shalt seek me in the morning, but I shall not be. I am pretty sure that if we submitted this piece of writing without any indication of where it came from to a psychiatrist, the diagnosis would be that this passage indicates or points to someone who is under severe depression. And therefore the solution, psychiatrist solution, would be antidepressants. Job is severely depressed, but what he needs are not antidepressants, but he needs the grace of God, which will come in due time. There are many words that need further explanation. Look at verse 12. Am I a sea or a whale that thou settest a watch over me? It makes no sense. Why is he talking about God watching over a sea or a whale? So let's look at the first word, sea. The Hebrew word is yom. It can mean the open sea. It can refer to a very large lake. Or it can refer to a very large river, like the river Nile. And which of these views you take will determine the meaning of that second word, which the KJV translators have rendered by the English word whale, which in Hebrew is tanin. Before we jump into this, we must bear in mind what is in view here when he refers to a sea, which it could be a large river, or it could be a huge lake, or it could be the open sea. What is in view here is not the sea as such, as a medium, but rather the sometimes unpredictable and uncontrollable behavior of the sea, particularly in stormy weather. And also, if you think about it, when the Nile overflowed its banks, the behavior of that flood water as it roared down the plains was unpredictable and uncontrollable. So that is the objective in view, that it is the unpredictable and tempestuous nature of the element, of the medium, the sea or the river, that is in view here. So with that understanding, why did the KJV translators pick on whale? The problem here is that their notes have not survived. So all we can do is make an educated guess. And my guess is they have used the rule of nearest context. In other words, the nearest context to whale would be the word yom. So what you make of it will determine what you make of the second word tanim, which literally means a monster of the sea or land. If you take the view that yom is the open sea, then the monster of the deep would naturally be the whale. But if you take the view that yom in Job's mind refers to the mighty river Nile, particularly when it overflows its banks annually, then the monster of the deep would not be the whale, but it would be the good old crocodiles, because the crocodiles of the Nile terrified the inhabitants of the plain for many centuries. To them, the monster is the crocodile. That's what they would understand it as. So if you put these two interpretations together, if you take the view that Job is referring to the river Nile, then you are bound to take the view that Tanim is not a whale, but it is a crocodile. Personally, I incline to the view that Job is in fact referring to the river Nile, and therefore to the crocodile as a monster thereof. If that is the case, verse 12 can be understood in this way. Job is saying, am I, O Lord, like the river Nile or a crocodile living therein, that you need to watch me so closely? If you put it that way, it makes sense. But bear in mind that there is this difference of interpretation. There will always be, particularly in books as complex as the book of Job. So my understanding of it is he's referring to the Nile and the crocodile, not in themselves, but from the point of view of, if you are living close to the banks of the river Nile, you would be on your guard every single day, because crocodiles are pretty fast even on the land as well as in the river. So you would need to be on your guard, vigilant every day. Of course, if you are living far away from the Nile, it is not a concern. So in the same way, he is complaining to God that God is watching him with that degree of intensity And he is basically saying, look, I am a poor, harmless guy. Why are you watching me as if I am such a threat like the crocodile of the Nile? Verses 13 through 15 is his complaint. And this is connected with the disease with which he has been inflicted. What he is saying is that I don't even have a moment of peace from this disease. My body is blasted with worm-infested ulcers, it's wasting away. My mind is harassed with fears. I'm tormented during my waking hours. The nights bring no relief because the Lord sends nightmares upon him. And under these conditions, what Job is expressing is that he longs for death in any form other than suicide. Never at any one moment throughout this book, even at his lowest ebb, has Job ever even contemplated taking his own life. To his great credit, to him that doesn't even come into the picture, because life belongs to God, is given by God, and only God can take it away. So other than suicide, any other form of death would be preferable to gain relief from this intensity of suffering. Verses 16 to 21, Job is being a little intemperate. Job is complaining that God is unfairly targeting him. And like a cat with a mouse, he says, God is keeping me alive because he's using me for target practice. So even though I am battered and bruised from head to foot, God is keeping my life going because he seems to take pleasure in using me as a target practice. For us today, looking at what he says, we are tempted to criticize him, but we need to be careful, because if we were in his situation, it is not clear that we would hold up as long as he did. In this section 16 to 21, there are just a few words that need explanation. In verse 16, he says, I loathe it, I would not live always. If you take this out of context, it would appear that he is seeking to depart earthly life as a form of escape. But in Job's case, it is not escapism. It is just a recognition that the life on earth is a very temporary affair, and we should organize our life on the understanding that we are just pilgrims passing through this earthly life. So he's not so much that he's trying to run away from life. His desire for death is understandable, but he is aware of the fact that earthly life is very tenuous, and therefore we should not plan and prepare as if we are going to be here forever. Verse 17, what is man that thou shouldest magnify him, and that thou shouldest set thine heart upon him? What it means is, set against the perfections of God, man is so very insignificant. Therefore, the attention that God is giving man, and himself in particular, noting every little defect, tracking every thing that he does, monitoring his motives, is uncalled for, because man, and himself in particular, is so very insignificant. It should not attract this degree of attention from God. If you look at it that way, the underlying sentiment is one of bitterness. He's basically telling God, look, all other arguments seem to fall on deaf ears. So how about this argument, Lord? Man does not deserve this kind of attention. So why are you using me as a representative of human beings for target practice? Aren't there better things you can do than to target me or any other human being in this way? It is a cry of bitterness given the nature and scope of his continuing afflictions. Verse 19 needs a little explanation. How long wilt thou not depart from me, nor let me alone till I swallow down my spittle? The depart there is the KJV rendition of the Hebrew word sha'ah, which means to gaze intently at and then look away. In other words, it indicates a close inspection. The second phrase that needs explanation, till I swallow down my spittle, is really a proverb and it should be understood as such. And the best way to understand this proverb is by way of an example. Person A says, allow me at least enough time to swallow my spittle. Person B responds with, don't worry, I'll wait until you have swallowed up the Tigris and the Euphrates. In other words, I'll give you all the time that you need. So if you understand it this way, verse 19 can be expressed as follows. When, O Lord, will this unremitting inspection of my life cease? Give me a break. When expressed in such language, it would be very comprehensible to us. He's asking God, look, whatever your reasons, I'm not going to argue about it anymore. Can't you just give me a break? Verse 20, there is a word that is rendered preserver, which needs explanation. O thou preserver of men. For reasons best known to themselves, the KJV translators rendered the Hebrew word natsa as preserver. If you check the Brown Driver Briggs lexicon, natsa could refer to one who watches over, who guards, who preserves. It may also, depending on the context, refer to one who conceals. But that, of course, is irrelevant in this particular context. So, what is being expressed here by Job is this. God keeps close track of every human being's thoughts, motives, and deeds. But he does so with a punitive motive in mind. In other words, the reason behind God watching every human being so closely is to punish them. Now we know, of course, that it's not true. But in his agony, it is understandable that he should have come to this unbalanced point of view. Verse 21. Why dost thou not pardon my transgression and take away mine iniquity? For now shall I sleep in the dust, and thou shalt seek me in the morning, but I shall not be. It is clearly bitter complaint. Because as Job says, I have dealt with all the particular sins in my life, and yet, in view of all these afflictions which the Lord keeps sending upon me, how can I have assurance of forgiveness? This is a problem that we are faced with today. We have made our peace with God, and yet God seems to send an overload of trials and problems upon us, and we are driven to a point where we don't have assurance of forgiveness. We're not even sure we are saved. So in Job's case, he is, in the light of his afflictions, he is not sure whether he has really been pardoned by God. But his problem, which is a problem that every believer has to learn anew, is that he had not come to the point of surrender. There comes a point in time where we as human beings, we are believers, may not be able to make sense of what is happening around us or to us. And in such situations, when we have tried our best to make sense of it, and we can't, we must be very careful, because if we insist on understanding here and now exactly why God deals with us in a certain way, then we will never come to a point of understanding, because there are certain things that God may see fit not to reveal to us this side of heaven. So the lesson we learn from Job in this situation is this. You can ask God for a reason why you are suffering this way. It may help you to bear the suffering. But if God sees fit to withhold those reasons from you, what are you going to do? Are you going to complain more and more? Are you going to challenge God? Are you going to abandon your faith, which can happen? It is a very real possibility. Or are you going to cling on with that tiny thread of faith that if you have come to that point, you say, Lord, I cannot make any sense of all of this. All I can do is surrender my life to you. Have thine own way. Job had not yet come to that point, and it will take him till chapter 42 to come to the point of realizing that the best way to be delivered from his suffering is to surrender himself to God and stop complaining. Because in chapter 42, finally in the verses 1, 2, 3 and 6, he testifies as follows. Then Job answered the Lord and said, I know that thou canst do everything and that no thought can be withholden from thee. Who is he that hideth counsel without knowledge? Therefore have I uttered that I understood not, things too wonderful to me which I knew not. Wherefore, verse 6, I abhor myself and repent in dust and ashes. We too could save ourselves a lot of agony if we stop struggling with God and surrender our case to God. There is a phrase in verse 21 that needs closer inspection, where Job says, for now I shall sleep in the dust. He expresses a similar view of death and of life after death in various places in the book of Job. For example, if you turn to chapter 14 and verse 13, Job says, oh, that thou wouldest hide me in the grave, that thou wouldest keep me secret until thy wrath is past, that thou wouldest appoint me a set time and remember me. For now should I have... And then you look at verse chapter 3, verse 13, similar thought. For now should I have lain still and been quiet, I should have slept, then had I been at rest. These verses reflect Job's limited understanding of what happens to a believer at the point of death. We must be very careful here, because at this early stage of the history of Revelation, there was very little that God had revealed to the saints about what happens to them immediately after death. And this is reflected in these words of Job in the verses that I have read to you. He is not sure what is going to happen to him at death. As far as he can make sense of it, the physical grave is the entrance to the place where the spirits of departed believers wait. The spirits of all departed believers and unbelievers wait until they face God in judgment. And of course, the place of departed spirits corresponds to what we know as Sheol, or in the Greek, Hades. What was not clear to Job is that at the moment of death, the soul of a believer is immediately in the presence of God. If you remember the two thieves who were crucified with Jesus, one of them railed on him, the other rebuked the first thief and said, we deserve our suffering. And then he turns to Christ and he says, Lord, remember me. And the words of Jesus, Luke 24 verse 43, verily I say unto thee, today shalt thou be with me in paradise. The today is a Greek word, semeron, which literally means this very day. So we are quite sure these are the words of Christ, and there's no higher authority, that at the moment of death, the soul of a believer is immediately in the presence of God. There is no place of waiting like Job thought. We know for a fact now that at death, we are immediately in the presence of God. And this is the basic hope of all believers, past and present, that at death they would be forever in the presence of God. And Job does testify on this basis in chapter 19, verse 25 through verse 27. I know that my Redeemer liveth, he shall stand at the latter day upon the earth. And though after my skin worms destroy this body, yet in my flesh, referring to the resurrection, shall I see God, whom I shall see for myself, mine eyes shall behold and not another. Though my reins, my physical body, be consumed within me. The basic hope of all believers is that at death they would be in the presence of God. Job's misconception was to think that there is a waiting period. There is, as Christ made it clear, there is no waiting period. And this is a great hope that we believers of the New Testament have, which the saints of the old never had. So we have come to the end of chapter 7. Next week we will consider Bildad's discourse in chapter 8.